A bomb explosion hits a bus in Afghanistan's Mazar-e-Sharif, leaving multiple casualties. Russia reports a drone attack targeting an airfield in a region bordering Ukraine. And in the UK, workers of a housing charity go on strike as part of massive walkouts by private and public employees. Hello, everybody, and welcome to World News. Our top story: in Afghanistan, an explosion rocks the capital of northern Balkh province, leaving at least 7 people dead. According to police in Mazar-e-Sharif, the bomb was placed in a cart by a local road. It went off as a bus carrying employees of a petroleum company was passing by. Blasts also wounded 6 people. There's been no claim of responsibility as of yet. Afghanistan, though, has been rocked by a number of similar incidents in recent months, some of which have been claimed by Daesh terrorists. Earlier this month, an explosion at a school in Mazar-e-Sharif claimed the lives of at least 19 people and injured over a dozen others. Since the beginning of recent riots in Iran, the country's officials have repeatedly blamed certain Western countries for inciting and fueling the violence. Now, a security source says those Western countries have set out no less than 4 conditions for renouncing support for rioters. Source told Iran's Al Alam news network, Western countries have demanded Iran unconditionally inject its oil and gas into the global market in the current critical climate. Agreeing to Western positions in the standoff over Iran's nuclear program was another term specified, and 2 other conditions entailed Iran going along with Saudi Arabia on regional issues and not cooperating with Russia. Riots in Iran broke out after the death of a young woman, Mahsa Amini, back in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and died at a hospital days later. Iran says more than 200 people, including security forces, innocent people, as well as rioters, have been killed in the unrest. And now back to our top story, where there's been more deadly violence in Afghanistan. This time, a cart placed by a road in northern Afghanistan has targeted a bus carrying petroleum workers, leaving multiple people dead and injured. Joining us now for all the details from Kabul is Rahmatullah Baghban. Hello, Rahmatullah. Hope you're safe and doing well. What can you tell us about this latest attack?
Today morning, a roadside bomb blast from Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan. The bus was carrying the employees of an oil company, and it was targeted by a mine that was planted on the roadside. According to security officials, the explosion has left 7 people dead and 6 others injured. However, eyewitnesses and local reporters say that the casualty is more than what is announced, because what they have reported is 15 people killed and 13 others are injured so far. The Taliban security forces in Mazar-e-Sharif have announced that they are in the area and they are starting an investigation into the attack. No individual or group so far has claimed responsibility. As you said, Afghanistan now, in the recent weeks, has been facing waves of deadly attacks. Last Friday, two terrorist incidents occurred in the capital, Kabul. One political leader, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, was targeted, but he was not hurt. 2 bodyguards of him were injured. And another in another attack in Kabul, Pakistan's Kabul mission was attacked and came under attack. However, neighboring countries, Kabul mission is safe and sound, but 1 bodyguard of him was also critically injured. Earlier this month, back in northern Afghanistan, which is the center of Samangan, witnessed actually a suicide bomb attack in which 19 people were killed and 27 others were injured.
Okay, Rahmatullah, thank you for the update from Kabul. Rahmatullah Baghban reporting. Now, Russia says a fresh drone attack has hit an airfield in the region bordering Ukraine. According to local officials, an oil storage tank was set ablaze due to the attack in the region of Kursk. The fire has reportedly caused no casualties. The incident took place today after Russia said Ukraine conducted drone attacks on two military airfields deep inside its territory. The Russian Defense Ministry has described Monday's strikes as an act of terrorism aimed at destabilizing the country's long-range aviation. It says attacks left three military personnel dead. Moscow says it'll responded, that is, by launching a massive strike against Ukraine's military control system and other targets. And as the war rages on in Ukraine, videos of Ukrainian war crimes against Russian troops continue to circulate online, causing shock and anger in Russia. Johnny Miller reports.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened, because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here, transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet, essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
Now let's turn to the UK, where hundreds of workers at a housing charity have launched an unprecedented two-week strike, joining other walkouts in private and public sectors. More than 600 workers at the charity began industrial action, and what their union described as a bitter dispute over pay. Now nurses, teachers, lawyers, train workers, and dock workers are among other groups that have gone on strike as well. They are angry at the cost of living crisis and insufficient pay rises that do not keep up with inflation. Just last week, the National Union of Rail, Maritime, and Transport Workers said that more than 40,000 workers will stage strikes in December and January, signaling major Christmas disruptions. The UK government is now considering using the military's help to fill in for striking workers ahead of key walkouts slated by nurses and ambulance staff. And the walkouts and their impacts on the British economy were the topic earlier of our news review program. Here it is.
To discuss that further, we're joined by Robert Carter, our correspondent in London, and also Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, joining us live from Bristol. Let's begin with our correspondent. Robert, give us an update on this most recent strike and, of course, the situation that Britain has been in over the past couple of months. We've been covering news of different industrial action over the past couple of months.
Sure. Well, of course, as you rightly mentioned, there's been many major strike actions taking place this year, and there's already plans being made to continue those actions well into next year as of January. So, of course, there are everything ranging from rail strikes on the horizon. There's postal strikes, strikes regarding the NHS, strikes regarding ambulance drivers. So really important sectors. And what really they're aiming to do is cause significant pressure for the government in the lead up to the Christmas holiday. So that's a time when, of course, packages will be flying up and down the country, letters, as well as a real need for healthcare and different public services. Transport services will be in very much in high demand during that period as well. And of course, this is very unwelcome news for the government, which is trying to convince the general public to digest many cuts in public spending and that type of thing. Now, shockingly enough, government minister has actually weighed into the row and has basically urged anyone considering going on strike going forward not to do so because it will benefit Putin. So he's tried to make some kind of foreign policy geopolitical statement suggesting that if you go on strike, you're basically helping Putin, which, according to the British government, is a foreign enemy abroad. So this is a comment which was very badly received, caused major condemnation from bosses of several trade unions who accused the government of being basically deeply offensive in using those comments. So the situation seems to be getting worse, not better. And in the days and weeks to come, strike action is still very much on the cards and could escalate well into next year.
Okay, so Mr. Gosling, you just heard the update from our correspondent on the situation on the ground. And we've also had news that these workers that are on strike are not agreeing to just any kind of pay rise. In particular, the most recent one, a 4% pay rise, was not accepted because it did not meet the demands of those workers. Do you believe that the UK government is capable to meet their demands at all?
Well, I think it wouldn't be no problem for them to. And even though many of these sectors have been partially or fully privatized, the government is still in the driving seat when it comes to negotiating. This 4% offer to the rail workers, well, it's really an insult. And, you know, what we're looking at in the UK is between 10 and 15% inflation. The idea is, of course, that the rail workers want to keep their standard of living, so they want a similar pay rise. 4% is nothing like that. And so in a way, the government, what it's trying to do, using the press to bamboozle the public if possible, is to say, well, we've given them an offer, you know, but they've turned it down. And it's fascinating to look at Nadeem Zahawi, the chairman of the Conservative Party, who made these comments about the strikers being in some way collaborating with Putin and the Russians. What's happening, I mean, for example, Zahawi, take a look at him. He's part of something called the Pinay Circle, along with several other ministers, or past ministers in the British government, which is this very private, secretive club of far-right former intelligence executives. So this, Le Cercle, they call it. It's initially started by Pinay, who's a French collaborator with the Nazis in the Second World War. And these people are actually, I think, making policy and making these statements as provocations. And what they're doing is they're saying effectively that we are the enemies not just of Russia, but of our own people, because they must expect as politicians that their own people will want to maintain their standards of living. If they don't, then they're at war with their own people. So we're looking at various different crises here in the UK. We've got the climate crisis, where this zero carbon policy is actually making things worse, not better. We're also looking, obviously, we've had the COVID thing recently with the policies there, with the vaccines, in many ways making things worse than they were, so that the cure is better, worse than the disease. And now this economic crisis, with the Russian sanctions massively increasing inflation in Britain and making things worse for the Brits. So you do have to wonder, is this deliberate? All these so-called solutions worse, making things worse. And that's why we've got the strikes, I think, and it's quite clear that even university staff, etc., now going on strike, that these public sector workers are going to maintain their living standards come what may. And the government, really for big business and the World Economic Forum, the globalists, is taking them on in order to try and break the union. So it's going to be a big battle.
Thank you very much. Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, joining us live from Bristol, and our very own Robert Carter, live from London. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed the escape of Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, the first Iranian president, from the country, and the election of Muhammad Ali Rajai. Today we are going to dwell upon the very short period of Rajai's presidency, which ended in his martyrdom by MKO terrorists. Stay tuned, please. After the dismissal of Abul Hassan Bani Sadr and his escape from the country, the second round of presidential elections were held in Iran in mid-summer 1981. Thus, Muhammad Ali Rajai was elected as the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran with 13 million out of 14.7 million votes. A few days after the elections, Rajai was endorsed as president by Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. In his edict of endorsement, Imam Khomeini had recommended Rajai to be loyal to his covenant with God, not to fear the reproaches of ill-wishers, and to devote himself to the service of downtrodden masses. During the ceremony, Rajai promised to put into effect the demands of the people. Muhammad Ali Rajai was an honest lover of Imam Khomeini and the people. He would humbly boast of having spent part of his life as a peddler. This way, he announced that he was quite familiar with the suffering of the poor and the needy. He had worked as a teacher for years and had also been tortured in the dungeons of the Pahlavi regime. One day after the endorsement of his presidency by Imam Khomeini, Rajai swore at the parliament, and soon he introduced Mohammad Javad Bahonar as his prime minister. Within a few days, his cabinet was approved by the MPs, and he started his work in early August 1981. One day, Rajai asked Haj Ahmad if he could meet Imam Khomeini's wife for condolences on the demise of her son-in-law. Having got the permission, Rajai went to Imam Khomeini's house, and Ms. Saghafi came to him. Muhammad Ali Rajai told her, "Condolences on passing away of Ayatollah Ishraqi. I ask you to pray for me not to be deceived by power. I have pleaded God for martyrdom." Imam Khomeini's wife told him, "I congratulate this responsibility to you and always pray for officials to serve the people well." The whole period of Rajai's presidency was less than 1 month. He was martyred while he was in a session with Prime Minister Muhammad Javad Bahonar at the Prime Minister's building. These two old friends were martyred through a bomb blast that had been placed in a tape recorder to record the negotiations. The plot was carried out by Masood Kashmiri, who was a member of the MKO terrorist outfit, but had been known as a sincere follower of Imam Khomeini and lover of the revolution and people. Amazingly, on the day of the funeral of the president and the premier, there was a coffin containing some ashes. It was said that the ashes belonged to Kashmiri, whereas he had exited the room of the session as soon as he had placed the record player and fled the country. Kashmiri had successfully deceived many officials through deceptive conduct. He would even adopt stances against the MKO terrorist grouplet in his talks with various officials. Imam Khomeini's wife, after hearing of Kashmiri's behavior and personality, had said, "Although we shouldn't be deceived by the appearance of people, this appearance shouldn't make us suspicious of everyone. I have a criterion here. If a person is more Catholic than the Pope, I become suspicious of him." Muhammad Ali Rajai's martyrdom was a very sad event in the history of the Islamic Revolution, as he was the symbol of rationality, devotedness, commitment, sincerity, and simplicity. Imam Khomeini described him, "Mr. Rajai was a man who had been a peddler, but this spirit was not impacted through the period of working as a peddler till presidency. It was not the chairmanship which had affected Rajai and Bahonar. Rather, they had affected chairmanship." In reaction to Bani Sa'd's stance, who had called Rajai as devoid of specialty and unqualified for premiership, the imam had said, Rajai's reasoning is superior to his knowledge. Ayatollah Khamenei described Rajai as an independent person who loved people and was a pain in the neck for liberalists and counter-revolution forces. Although the martyrdom of Muhammad Ali Rajai and Muhammad Javad Bahonar was a shock to the people, within a month after this sad event, the third round of presidential elections was held in the country and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was elected as president with 95% of the votes. Dear listeners, we will continue the discussion in the next episode.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian during an arrest raid in the occupied West Bank. As bad as that may sound, it falls pale in comparison to the brutality of the Israeli regime's track record recently, which includes killings on a daily basis, one execution style, and another to have killed five in one day. These incidents follow months of tensions that have deepened since Israeli forces began a crackdown in the occupied West Bank back in March in response to a series of attacks by Palestinians inside of Israel. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why Israel has ramped up its spree of killings and whether we are on the cusp of another intifada. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Fraud Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Frahis, I'll first start with you, and we'll start with the Gaza Strip. We have had Israel attack the Gaza Strip in overnight strikes against some sites of the Hamas resistance group. It came after a rocket was fired from Gaza, and also at the center of it was two members of the Islamic Jihad who were killed in a raid by the Israeli forces in the West Bank town of Jenin. This obviously comes now with almost a new administration in place, if there is one, that can be efficient in terms of the plight of Palestinians. What do you think about what has occurred?
I just think it's a natural continuation and possible expansion of Israeli Zionist control, genocide, and the fact that they are trying to
you know, force Palestinians to conform to Israeli law. Now, I understand, you know, especially in the West Bank, that Palestinians are treated under military law and the settlers are treated under civilian Israeli law. But it really is a continuation of Israel's past extremist balance. You've already mentioned that, like, nearly every day we are hearing of unarmed Palestinians being summarily extrajudicially murdered by the Israeli state. We hear about either house demolitions or we hear about houses being sequestered by the Zionist settlers. We have land stolen in the Dummins every day, and there appears to be no end in sight. And, you know, when I hear of the dawn raids that take place at 20 past 4 in the morning in and around Jenin and Nablus and Ramallah and Nabi Saleh and Bet Sahur and Bethlehem and any village and any Palestinian homeland or town in the occupied West Bank, I sometimes think this is just Deir Yassin on a slightly smaller scale. If we remember, it was on the 9th of April in 1948, 120 members of three terrorist organizations that were set and designated as terrorists by the British under the British mandate. You had the Irgun, the Lehi, and the Haganah, some of whom members went on to become the Israeli Defense Force. Terrorists in 1948, and somehow they're defending the state in 2022. But those people went in and they murdered between 100 and 250 Palestinian men, women, and children. There are reports that they mutilated the bodies, that an 8-month-old pregnant woman was shot point blank in the belly, that they robbed the dead and they stole things from the houses. And nothing really happens separate to that today. When you hear Palestinians saying that they are all kind of corralled into one room while the IDF illegally, as part of their illegal occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people, search their homes, and then people find money missing and jewellery missing. These people, the Palestinians who resist today are the descendants of the victims of 1948, and the Israeli Zionists who oppress those Palestinian descendants today, many of whom are descendants of the Irgun, the Lehi, and the Haganah, who were terrorists. I believe even today the IDF is a terrorist organization, and that while they continue to steal the land, steal the houses, steal the possessions, and steal the very lives of Palestinians, we are just witnessing from the outside an ongoing, continuing genocide.
Let's talk about an incident that happened, Kevin Barrett, where you had a very, very horrific execution-style death of a Palestinian, which happened at point-blank range. This happened about 48 hours ago. And it comes, first of all, I don't know if you've seen that footage or not, and the way that this Palestinian was killed, Kevin Barrett. Give us your reaction to that as to why a police officer would actually, or I'm assuming it's a police officer, maybe it was just a security officer, would do that.
Well, this is completely typical behavior, actually, by Israeli forces, which routinely shoot unarmed Palestinians. So in a sense, it's nothing all that surprising. And the Israelis routinely lie about it and cover up for the killers. And that seems to have happened in this case, where clearly this Palestinian was unarmed, and yet they lied later and tried to make it sound like it was some kind of knife attack. In fact, what had happened was a dispute with...
Yeah, but I'm sorry to jump in, but the thing is, when you look at the footage, you see them scuffling, the security officer and the Palestinian, and then the police officer takes out a gun and shoots them three times, I think, right at point-blank range. And then they don't allow the ambulances to get to the side of the scene. That's not, I don't know if that's typical, but I don't think it's typical. But my question is, what would motivate, or what would be a reason for a police officer, Israeli police officer, or security officer, to feel that it could do that?
Well, unfortunately, it is somewhat typical in that Israeli forces feel that they have carte blanche to execute Palestinians in cold blood, and they've been doing so. Essentially, as the other guest correctly said, since 1948. even longer, actually. If you read Thomas Suarez's book, State of Terrorism, you'll see that these terror groups that later became the IDF were already slaughtering people, including even some Jewish people, and of course, the British, decades before that. So it's true. It's shocking. It's vastly worse than the kinds of things we've seen here in the United States that got the BLM movement going, where Americans get slaughtered by police. But it's vastly worse in occupied Palestine. It's true that in many cases in the past, it's been done at a longer distance by snipers, which is the more typical way that the Israelis just execute Palestinians with impunity. Sure. But in this particular case, though, I think perhaps they've been emboldened to do more of this and to lie more outrageously about it.
That's it, isn't it? I mean, this is what happened days after when there was a separate incident. You had the Israeli police chief praising officers for killing a Palestinian, which they alleged to have carried out a car ramming attack. And this is what that police officer, or the police chief, I should say, said: "A dead terrorist is what I want to see." So my question is, Frahius, is that then protocol? Is that what they're taught? Is that what they're told to do?
I'm going to say yes, and I'm not going to suggest that they're potentially taught to do that, but I think it would be something that is maybe discussed among the police and discussed among the soldiers and is tacitly accepted by the state and the government when we consider how few soldiers, IDF members, Jerusalem police, etc., border police, have ever been brought to justice for their criminal crimes against the Palestinian people. I have always in my heart seen a parallel, not just between Ireland, where I'm from, and the fate of the Palestinians, but also the state of the American Indians, which perhaps our fellow guests could maybe touch on. And I've always seen a parallels between the Wild West and the Middle East. We had a white European colonization of the Americas, which ended with something like 150 million indigenous people dying. And we have the exact same resume in Israel and Zionism against the indigenous Palestinian population. So in America, once upon a time, they said the only good Indian was a dead Indian. I think we're watching the same parallel, the same consensus, the same dehumanization of the Palestinian indigenous people of the region, the Arab collective in its totality, and the Persians of Iran, all being demonized and all being set under the same kind of headline of the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian, the only good Arab is a dead raghead, and the only good Iranian is a dead Persian. And I think that is exactly what is happening. It's what we're witnessing being borne out on the streets. And I think it's an ideology that akin to what we saw in the Second World War.
Well, it's not something that, again, this program nor the station is just coming out and presenting out in this particular program here, Kevin Barrett. You have many human rights groups, and this is very telling, I think, and it needs to come out in the open. Many human rights groups are accusing Israel's civilian leadership, according to this one particular source, of the responsibility for transformation of police officers and even of armed civilians into judges and executioners. Human rights groups cumulatively have said that, who slay Palestinians suspected of armed attacks in the streets. So we've reached either this point at some, I don't know when, but it seems like obviously it's been going on for quite some time, in order for human rights groups to come out and make this statement.
Well, that's right. The violence is just over the top, the extremity of it. And now we're reaching the point that the very, very top people in Israel are not only sort of tacitly allowing it and looking the other way, but they're actively encouraging it. Ben-Gavir, this new kingmaker who's joining Bibi Netanyahu for the new Netanyahu regime, he actually called this killer of the most recent killing, of that close-range execution-style murder of that unarmed Palestinian, he called him a national hero. And that's what we've come to expect. And I think the other guest is right. There is a parallel between this kind of extreme bloody-mindedness and just genocidal intent in Israel today, and what we saw at some of the worst moments in the genocide of the Native Americans here in the United States. To get a taste of what that was like, I urge people to read Cormac McCarthy's brilliant novel, Blood Meridian, which brings that the worst of that to life and is quite reminiscent of the mentality of the Zionists. And I also think the other guest in talking about this being a genocide, that is, Professor Francis Boyle has written a very clearly reasoned argument according to which, under international law, what's being done to the Palestinians does constitute a genocide. So now they seem to be ramping up this long-term slow-motion genocide, and they have Ben Gavir actually coming into the government on this platform of endorsing expelling or murdering all Palestinians. And he's right. a worshiper of Baruch Goldstein, the terrorist who slaughtered about 30 Palestinian worshipers at prayer in the Hebron massacre. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Ben Gavir, had his poster up in his house, and he basically honors that kind of guy. So Israel is completely going insane, and even its strongest supporters in the United States, like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, are now starting to admit it.
Well, I'm so glad, first of all, that you mentioned Ben Gavir. Let's break open his personality here, Fra Hughes. He actually poured fuel on the violence that occurred in the occupied West Bank. Not the violence, the incident that happened in the occupied West Bank where you had the double bombing that took place on the bus stops. He came out and he said that he is calling for the extrajudicial execution of Palestinian resistance leaders when that happens. I mean, this guy is supposed to be the incoming national security minister in Israel, and he's calling for the execution of Palestinians. He is so bad of a character that members of the Biden administration have signaled they're not going to engage with him. So that shows how bad this guy is. And of course, he's pro-settler, and he's I don't want to use the word extreme because he goes even beyond that word. Is this system by design? Because it's supposedly because Netanyahu needed his coalition in order to obviously have a majority.
Okay, well, I think what we could do is break that down into two or three separate component parts. I mean, supposedly when Israel, which I do not believe has a legitimate right to exist because it was built on terrorism and the murder of the indigenous Palestinians. That said, the original people involved in the likes of the Irgun and potentially the fledgling IDF were politically to the left. They were not Zionist by religion, they were Zionist by politics. Many of them were atheists and non-religious. So if you look at the transformation of not just progressive, and they're not progressive, but you know, the government after government after government from 1948 onwards, we have witnessed a slow trajectory move to the right all the way through, which ended up bringing us the likes of Netanyahu, who instead of being impeached in government is now going on to form the new government within the Zionist state. So the settler movement is very much a religious movement and very much believes that every inch of land of Palestine was given to them by God as expressed in the Torah or whatever kind of biblical fantasy that they choose to believe in. So what we have witnessed is this slow encroachment to the right, bit by bit by bit by bit, to the point where we have something like, I don't know, is it slightly less than a million illegal settlers, like 4.2 million Palestinians in the West Bank, but nearly 1 million settlers in the West Bank. These people are all armed. I've seen them with their AR-15 rifles walking around Jerusalem. I think what we're witnessing is the final solution, and the final solution is to put the Palestinians out of the West Bank and steal as much land and water resources as the Zionists possibly can.
Well, this is something that's very interesting here, Kevin Barrett, and we need to also cover this, and that's about this so-called normalization that has happened between the Persian Gulf Arab leaders and Israel. There was an event that was held in Al-Quds, of which the UAE ambassador was present at that event. And he had Ben Gavir, who was also there. And they were seen shaking hands, making goodwill gestures towards each other. And at that event, Ben-Gavir comes out and says something that he's very proud of, and that is the fact that he has made peace with Arab states without making any concessions. Now, if I'm the UAE ambassador, I'm wondering, wait a minute, what is he saying, unless he knows? And second of all, if I'm a Palestinian and I read that, then obviously it shows how Palestinians have been robbed by their leaders.
Indeed. Well, it's kind of astounding that the UAE leader would be meeting with Ben-Gavir, who is on the record as being a rabid anti-Arab racist who basically feels that the only good Arab is a dead Arab. And the UAE, these people are Arabs. They speak Arabic. So that's kind of bizarre. That's like a, you know, an African-American leader meeting with somebody who wants to exterminate all the black people. It's just, it kind of boggles the mind. But it does illustrate the fact that there's a huge gap between the sold-out element among these Gulf oil states that have made this deal with the Zionist regime and the people of the region and the Arab world who do not agree with this. And that's absolutely clear at the World Cup, where people from and Qatar and which also same deal with the Zionists and other Arab world, clear that they have nothing to do with the Zionist entity, that they don't believe it's legitimate. They refuse to talk to the Zionist journalists. And even Newsweek magazine, a pro-Zionist mainstream American publication, just came out with a pretty good, accurate article on this, how the winner of the World Cup is Palestine, because nobody at the World Cup accepts the legitimacy of the Zionist entity, and they've made it absolutely clear. And yet these crazy leaders, like of the Emirates and these other countries, keep pretending that the Zionist regime is okay and meeting with even the worst of their leaders like Ben-Gavir. So that split between the people of the region and the leadership is ultimately going to a much more open and intense conflict.
Well, you mentioned that, and it's a great thing that you did, because obviously we're in the latter half of the World Cup, but it was very evident based on the different instances there, Frahis, that the Arab citizens know that there's no legitimacy to be held when it comes to Israel. So can you give us a little bit more about how this divergence, not divergence, but this distance that exists between their leaders and their viewpoint, what is that a reflection of? And I guess the bigger question is, what did these Arab leaders gain from the so-called normalization, if it appears that Israel has made out the most, so to speak, of this so-called normalization?
Okay, well, firstly, the only people who make anything, any traction or any kind of political progress from the normalization is Israel. Israel seeks legitimacy within the region. Israel seeks to be able to allow its citizens to go to Saudi Arabia on holiday, to go to Morocco on holiday, to go to Egypt on holiday, to feel that they are accepted outside of the occupation areas. But we've always seen that the only people who have stood by the people of Palestine are the Syrian Arab Republic, the Republic of Iran, and the people of Yemen, Colonel Gaddafi, and several others. So what we witness when we see the normalization and the gulf that you've talked about or alluded to between the people and the governments, that gulf is all over the world. Many people in Ireland support the right for justice, dignity, and self-determination for the Palestinian people on either a two-state solution or a one-state solution where it's called Palestine and people are treated with equality underneath the law. But that's not the view of the Irish government. That's not the view of the British government. That's not the view of the American government. That's not the view of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and other Gulf nations who are beholden to, or were until very recently, beholden to the American and British administrations. Mm-hmm. And these people sometimes think my enemy's enemy is my friend. So, okay, you know, if you're against Iran, the same as Israel is, then you're in favor of normalization.
Last question goes to you, Kevin Barrett. Top military intel officer in Israel has said that the occupied West Bank violence is only going to get worse. Quote, Israel was not merely facing a wave of terror, as many officials have described it. They describe it that way. But that these young Palestinians' anger is fueling their energy, of which it's faltering in terms of Israel's security apparatus. Are we looking at this getting worse, and to the degree where an intifada may take place? In less than a minute, please.
Yes, I think we are. Obviously, there are very good reasons for the Palestinians to be especially angry right now, with this genocidal Ben-Gavir joining the new Netanyahu government, and with this upswing of these slaughters of Palestinians. So these are provocations. It's as if the Zionists are deliberately willing to up the ante, and they're provoking intifada, and they kind of have the tiger by the tail, because they can't stop that intifada. They can't really win militarily, and they can't go and execute all the Palestinians the way Ben-Gavir would like. And ultimately, there are a whole lot of rockets behind with Hezbollah. The Islamic Republic of Iran have their back, that a genocide is not possible, but that's what the new Israeli regime is devoted to. So something has to break here, and we'll see what it is.
Thank you very much for that, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today from Madison Frah Hughes. Pleasure, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atah, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have a very special guest speaker, Dr. Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
One of the rituals of the Muslims is doing tayammum. We can say, which we have to be more familiar with in your speech, inshallah. But one major question is that tayammum on a dirty dust or a dirty soil, isn't it in contradiction with the nature of Islam, which encourages, we can say, health and hygiene very much?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that for some of the rituals, we are in need of kind of purity. And that purity is mainly through ablution, wudu, the minor ablution, yes, and the major ablution that is called ghusl. But in some cases, in different cases which are mentioned in the books of jurisprudence, people may have no access to water, or the water might be harmful. And for other scenarios, they need to do tayammum instead of wudu or ghusl. And for tayammum, you are in need of some soil. And of course, it can be a piece of rock and a stone as well. But we are in need of the soil. Now, the question is whether it is, as you mentioned, in line with the Islamic instructions about hygiene and health. So first of all, we need to refer to the fact that when it comes to Islamic laws, some people think that we know all the philosophies and wisdoms for the Islamic laws. This is not the case. For some of the Islamic laws, the philosophies are mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, but still it doesn't mean that the full philosophy is mentioned. So yes, ablution wudu may help the people for, purification of the body, for hygiene. But is ablution wudu only for this purpose? Not necessarily. There might be other philosophies that we are not aware of. So this is a general point when it comes to the philosophies of Islamic laws. Of course, we do believe that all of them are based on wisdom, divine wisdom, but it doesn't mean that we may know all the philosophies. To the extent that they are mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, we may find the philosophies, but we cannot go beyond that. This is one point as a kind of introduction. Now, having said that, is tayammum against hygiene? The point is that, first of all, who has claimed that to do tayammum, to have a kind of touching with the soil, is going to bring you, dirt and make you,
unclean. Yes.
In that case, we should claim that all the workers who are always busy and dealing with the soil in the construction, should be always in the hospital. This is not the case. Mm-hmm. According to some, they even might be stronger than other people. Okay. So in and of itself, we cannot claim that touching the soil would bring you any kind of disease. And the second point is that, according to the science, even if you have clean and dry soil, it is immune to the germs and microbes. And it is well documented in today's scientific discoveries. And also they mentioned that there are some particles inside the soil that they are able to remove the germs too. That is why if you imagine of a carrion of a corpse which is put under the soil after a few days, it would be demolished completely. And one of the reasons is that the soil is able to remove all the germs and microbes in that body.
That's right.
So if you have a dry...
Even soil can be used as a cleaner in Islam, isn't it?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's right. I will come to that. When it comes to...
The tools of cleaning...
A dish which is impure because of a dog, for example, one of the ways is to use soil for purifying that dish. So my point is that the dry and the clean soil, even according to discoveries of today's science, is not a factor for uncleanliness, rather it is able to remove the germs. And the next point is that the verse talking about the concept of tayammum, which is in chapter An-Nisa, verse 43, reads, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ فَتَيَمَّمُوا صَعِيدًا طَيِّبًا. In this verse, the word which is used as a kind of attribute and feature for that soil is طَيِّب, meaning that it should be a clean one, a pure one. And that is why I'm repeating my point is that a clean, dry soil is free of any kind of germ, and even it's able of removing the germs and microbes. And not only that, we have some narrations in this regard. In Wasa'il al-Shi'a, there is a chapter called Kirahatu Tayammum Bituraban Yuta wa Turabat Tariq. It is makruh, it is disliked for you to do tayammum through a soil which is, in the alleys, in the streets, and people walk on.